the notion that America can handle its own diversity and that other nations should follow our lead, that may be short-sighted, especially in the wake of the 2016 presidential election, where political tribalism has been even more evident each day in America and documented by media outlets post-election. We're talking about it on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The U.S. is not immune to the destructive forces of political tribalism. That's according to Amy Chua. She is a professor at Yale Law School and author of several books, including her latest, Political Tribes, Group Instinct, and the Fate of Nations. Amy, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, before we really dive deep into this topic, help us understand, what is tribalism?
Well, tribalism can be used in lots of different ways. So a tribe can refer to something very literal and specific, like an actual tribe, like the Pashtun tribes in Afghanistan. I'm not using it in that very technical sense. Some people use tribalism to refer to ethnic affiliation, so they'll speak of the Japanese tribe. But tribalism can also apply to sort of modern political or identity-driven group memberships. So the way that I'm using it is simply to refer to group identities that have a real grip on you so that your own identity becomes really bound up with the group, so that you start to see everything through your group's lens and just kind of want your group, you think your group is right all the time, basically, you will defend it no matter what. So there are lots of different kinds of tribes, and they're not all bad. You know, a family is a tribe, and religions can be very produce very tribalistic loyalties. Sports is a really good example of tribalism, but it's when tribalism takes over a political system that things get really dangerous, because at that point you see everything through the lens of your tribe, whether that is Sunni or Shia or Republican or Democrat or pro-Trump or anti-Trump, and facts and arguments, statistics start not to matter. All these interesting studies show that people will interpret facts to fit the worldview, the viewpoint of their side. So you can show a group of people the same statistics about gun control, you know, the same facts, same numbers, and half will conclude, looking at those numbers, that's why we need fewer guns, and the other half, looking at the same numbers, will conclude, that's why we need more guns.
And is that when tribal identity really goes off the rails, when we stop our ability to see outside of our tribe?
It is. It's also what begins to fracture nations, because what happens is we can't talk to each other. You know, we need to have some incredibly difficult conversations in this country. Yes, about gun control, but also about immigration. You know, there are no easy answers, and we really need to have this complicated, difficult, thorny public debate with both sides. But what happens when you get a system is seized by political tribalism is everybody's view gets more extreme. So right now, you know, it used to be that Democrats and Republicans had much more overlap on all kinds of issues. Immigration, there was actually a lot of people in the middle, Democrats and Republicans, people argued. Right now, you have Democrats polling, surveys show, way more extreme on immigration. Not necessarily, you know, open borders, but much, much more extreme. And Republicans way more extreme on the right, not exactly no immigration, but wanting to cut down. And even worse than that, it's almost like a game of gotcha. Like one side will say something and the other side will accuse it of being racist and xenophobic. Mm-hmm. Or the other side will say something and language that you'll hear about, oh my gosh, you're bringing in murderers and rapists. And it's just completely unproductive with everybody furious at each other and zero progress. I mean, it's just really, we can no longer speak to each other as fellow Americans.
Amy, how do you trace this? Where's the evolution of this tribalism, this fierce political identity, getting us to this point here in America?
Great question. So first of all, we have always been tribal. Every one of us, human beings are, we're kind of hardwired to be tribal. And America has always been tribal too. The difference is that for most of our 200-year history, the United States was dominated economically, politically, and culturally by a white majority. Obviously, the term white, you know, was kind of a moving target. Many groups that are considered white today were not considered fully white before. But basically, that was the dynamic. So there was all kinds. It felt like there was no tribalism, but that's just because there was one big, powerful tribe superimposing its identity over everybody else, the white majority, and, you know, extinguishing, you know, people killing off populations, and just basically suppressing all kinds of other smaller tribes and groups. So in a way, a lot of the turbulence and difficulty that you see now is really just the healthy outgrowth of a lot of formerly silenced groups finally being allowed to voice themselves. But what happened is, to answer your question, in the last 30 years, the United States has gone through a massive demographic transformation. And this is the result of much larger immigration flows, I mean, just in absolute terms, mm-hmm. but also a change in where our immigrants are coming from. It used to be, for most of our history, that our immigrants came from Europe and were largely white. In the last 30 years, most of our immigrants have come from Latin America, Asia, like my own parents, Africa, and other parts of the developing world. So that whites today are on the verge of losing their majority status. The predictions are that usually they say that by around 2044, whites will no longer be a majority at the national level. So this is really important because what it means is that every group in America is now threatened. You know, it used to be just minorities who felt threatened and persecuted. But now, not only minorities, but whites feel threatened. A really remarkable study shows that 67% of working class white Americans feel that they are the subject of more discrimination than minorities. Not just Muslims and Jews feel threatened. Christians today feel threatened. You can really hear that in the political rhetoric. Not only women feel threatened, I mean, women certainly feel threatened with Donald Trump in the White House, but with the Me Too movement, men feel threatened. Straights and gays feel threatened. Latinos, Asians, every group feel threatened today. So, and when, it's when groups feel threatened that they retreat into insularity, that they close ranks and become more defensive and more insular and more us versus them. And that's why you are seeing in the United States today the rise of very open and strident identity politics on both sides of the political spectrum. You know, openly a white nationalist movement. It used to just be underground. And identity politics flourishing on the left as well. That's one reason why we're experiencing what we're experiencing. The second reason, by the way, is something that often gets missed, and that's simply that class, or even more accurately, educational differences has divided America's white majority. The difference now between the what we call coastal elites, but that's kind of a misnomer. I mean, you know, kind of cosmopolitan urban whites and whites in the middle of America, rural whites, southern whites, that divide has gotten so intense. There's almost no interaction between those two groups. There's a lot of mutual suspicion and hostility in both directions. And the intermarriage rates between those two groups is so low now that it's almost like an ethnic division. So that's another reason that America today is in some ways quite different than it was, than it has been for 200 years.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with author Amy Chua. She writes that identity politics, political correctness is actually tearing the country apart. Her new book is called Political Tribes, Group Instinct, and the Fate of Nations. She's a Yale Law School professor. Getting your insights on identity in America, 800-642-1234. What do you consider to be your quote-unquote tribe? How do you identify yourself? Are you an American first, or does that fall down the list? What do you think of the role of group identity or tribes in American foreign policy? Call in at 800-642-1234 to join the conversation. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll be picking up the conversation after a news update. Hear your thoughts on this right here on the Ideas Network. Stay with us. Some recent polling finds that a majority of white Americans believe there is discrimination against white people in America today. There is that to fold into this narrative as we explore tribalism here in the U.S. and abroad. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Amy Chua's new book is Political Tribes, Group Instinct, and the Fate of Nations. She is a law professor at Yale Law School. And let's go straight now to your observations at 800-642-1234 with Jeremy leading us off in Racine. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm wondering if there's any correlation in regards to how the political ads have been kind of transforming over the last 10 years to be really decisive, and the type of language that they're using against their opponents could have a contributing factor. And your guess is absolutely right in regards to even Christian groups feel that they're under attack. I just heard on DCY this morning how a commission in Milwaukee is setting up an ordinance in regards to LGBT, and DCY is basically stating that they're under attack. The very Bible is under attack, and pastors need to be careful. So they're having like emergency meeting. But the type of language that they're using really speaks to an extreme level of political football in here.
Well, Jeremy, thanks for calling in. Amy, political ads contributing to tribalism. What do you make of that?
That's a very, very good insight. There are all these things today that are contributing, actually. First of all, when people feel threatened, I mean, there's a chicken and egg problem. When people start to feel threatened, a lot of politicians and political groups can discover that it's a great way to generate support for themselves, because it's human nature. You feel threatened, and then somebody taps into that fear. They say, you know what, it's actually the reason that you don't have a job is because these people took it, or, you know, these core beliefs that you have, these people are trying to take it away. And it's so yes, political ads, also sort of demagogic politicians. Because this book looks at America through the lens of other countries, it becomes really clear when you see us as part of a pattern. You know, people did this, Milosevic did this in Yugoslavia to pit the Serbs against the Croatians, and then the Croatian politicians did the same to pit the Croatians against the Serbs. Social media plays a huge role too. You know, social media is, you get the most likes and clicks, if you post really moderate, thoughtful things, but if you post kind of outrage-producing statements that make people very upset. So there are a lot of reasons, but yes, I think he's definitely right that that's one factor.
Let's bring in Todd now in Green Bay. Hi, Todd.
Good morning. Good morning to your guests. One of the things that is really dividing us is political correctness, which I think your guest has written about, and it's high time that someone did. The problem that you have is that it's always used to silence a debate on our major topics. You can't bring up, for instance, the word urban without somebody saying, you mean black, if they're talking about inner city problems. You can't say inner city, because that means black also. And there's any number of ways that political correctness is used. But the problem, and the one thing that that baffles me is why people don't see this, is that while the left is always telling us that we need to be tolerant, they are always the ones who impose political correctness on us to kill debate. I can't think of a single politically correct term that's been coined by anyone on the right or a conservative, Republican or conservative for that matter. It seems to always be one-sided, and it's always used to silence any real debates.
Amy, how is political correctness silencing debate? Do you see that?
Yes, I see it as more of a just a national game of gotcha. But I agree with the caller very much that I think we all need to elevate ourselves. Here's the thing. I teach on a liberal college campus, and I am so well-trained to try to keep up with this very, very ever-changing vocabulary about how to not offend people. You know, I mean, and the vocabulary changes all the time, and there are lots of different new terms. And I get where a lot of those terms are coming from. A lot of things start authentically. But where it gets crazy and where I agree with the caller is that we need to have some conversations right now. And so if it's hard for somebody like me that is on a college campus, somebody that is from a small town in the Midwest or just from, you know, anywhere in America who hasn't been exposed to all these terms may articulate, take immigration. They may say, you know, I'm worried about immigration, or I'm worried about these cities, or you know, how do we have the rules for who gets to come in? And they could easily express themselves in a way that is not how our kind of politically correct rules demand. And instantly you will see that person being, oh, my God, you're a racist, you're a xenophobe, calling the person out. And I agree. What that does is it stops debate, often just on a sort of a technical wording problem. It's very ungenerous. And then the result is that it when you shut people down like that, it doesn't just go away. Those people get resentful, and it goes underground, and then people start to talk amongst themselves. And I think that breeds intolerance, for example, on the right, too, because now you're talking only amongst yourself. You're viewing all the people on the left being these terribly politically correct people who are silencing you, and it just gets more and more extreme in both directions. So I think that there is some blame on the right, too. It doesn't take the form of political correctness. But similarly, it's kind of like you'll see some action that the left is doing, and instead of really kind of trying to understand why are they feeling this way, somebody just puts a quick tag on it. They're whining again. They want to, you know, take, you know. So I just feel like this book, I'm writing from outside one of the political tribes, and I'm kind of getting a lot of criticism from both and saying, without trying to point fingers, you know, how can we overcome this acrimonious moment where we are? And because I look at other countries that we think of as nothing like ourselves, you know, I say, look, you know, we're starting to behave like Venezuela, which is like a failed state, and well, people are starving. By realizing that the stakes are very high, I try to point the way. Here are things that we can draw on to save this country. It's worth saving. We have a lot of problems, but we don't want to fracture into 10 pieces or 50 pieces or 2 pieces.
Amy, you label Americans as a supergroup. Why do you do that? And what is the role of this supergroup in the context of our world?
This is so important. It's something so special about America. And in this kind of battle between the left and right, you know, it's always like, what? What are you saying? It's a very simple concept. A supergroup is incredibly rare. In fact, America is the only major nation, major power to be one. A supergroup needs to satisfy 2 simple conditions. First, it needs to have a very strong, overarching national identity, like American. And second, it needs to let individual subgroup identities flourish. So you can be, I'm Irish American, or I'm Egyptian American, or Italian American, or Japanese American, and still be able to be very patriotic at the same time. So that you don't need to pick, you know, we shouldn't have to pick, am I American first, or am I, you know, proud of my Irish background first. And we don't need to, because our Constitution And look, our founders did have slaves. We are an incredibly imperfect country. We have repeatedly failed to live up to our Constitution. But the Constitution itself, even if the founders were imperfect, the Constitution itself prescribes that our national identity is ethnically and religiously neutral. It doesn't belong to any one particular subgroup, not the WASPs, not the, you know, this group or that group. It is neutral, not, and that is very, very special. We have a group transcending national identity. So what I say is that if we try to work our way back to overcome all these changes and turbulence we're experiencing, we want to look back about what makes us special. And we can't tear down our national identity. We can still be, we can be tribal. We can keep our, you know, some people are very religious. Some people are feel very strongly about, you know, Black Lives Matter. Some people feel strongly about this or that. But we, in at our best, we are not only about our tribes. We are not only tribal. We also have this, have to have this common sense of also being Americans. And that's what we're losing right now. We're starting to view people who voted on the other side, not just as people that we really disagree with, but dangerously, we're starting to view those other people as almost like immoral, like the enemy. And that is, again, very dangerous. We need to kind of roll that back and figure out how we can start to listen to each other again. We can still passionately disagree, but we can't just say, you know, those people are all X, Y, Z, whatever you want to call them, racists or bigots or, you know, killers or whatever. We need to see each other as fellow Americans. Otherwise, we're just not going to remain the same country that we are.
If you're just joining us, Amy Chua is with us. Her book is Political Tribes, Group Instinct and the Fate of Nations. You can join this conversation about political tribalism. How do you see it? 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Nick to the conversation. Nick joining us from Detroit. Hi, Nick.
Hello.
Go ahead.
I guess in Wisconsin, that's where I'm from. I'm just traveling, but I don't see any more stronger tribalism than in Wisconsin, Democrats versus Republicans, or I guess Republicans versus everybody else, because we really don't have much of a Democratic Party. I mean, fighting against this, but I mean, just their takeover of our entire state has just been unprecedented. I mean, it's created such a hostile environment to live in.
How so, Nick?
Well, I mean, just look at Foxconn. We all have to pay for this now. I mean, they just changed the wetland laws where they can develop wetlands without a permit in certain situations. I mean,
so you see policy changes as informing and kind of the current here in political tribalism. Is that right?
Policies that get jammed through within weeks with no discussion, with one-sided power dynamics, yes.
Nick, let's get Amy to respond. Go ahead, Amy.
Nick, I think you're putting your finger on something really important. Again, this is kind of strange to bring in a country like Iraq because you might think, oh, we have nothing in common. But what happened in that situation was the one group, the Sunnis, were really dominant for a long time, about 15%. And they were very, very bad to the other groups, like the Shias. And when the Shias finally, through democracy that we put in there, thinking it was going to cure everything after we invaded, they used that new power for payback, for revenge. And this is one really destructive thing about political tribalism. Once you take power, instead of saying, okay, now we have the majority, now let's work with the other side, we're going to favor our own ideology. That's just the fact of it. But you go beyond that and say, now we're just going to, you know, almost like take revenge. And it goes into a terrible cycle because, you know, the caller might feel much better when the Democrats take back because I think he's Democrat. But the danger of our country is like swinging back and forth between these like revengeful polar tribes because and I've heard a lot of, most of my friends are progressive and so upset about the judiciary being filled with conservatives, and their language is understandable but also scary, again, because I've looked at other countries, how quickly you can descend. It's like, when it's our turn, we're going to do all this. So that's why I keep saying, you know, the reason I wrote this book is to show people through the lens of some other nations that we can't just think small, that we need to remember what it is that makes this country special. Not to say that we have been perfect, but to get back to a point where we are not just further and further descending into this destructive cycle. And part of that is just, you know, kind of what the caller was describing, this almost gleeful ramming through of things that will only provoke an equal and opposite reaction down the line.
Let's go to Steve now in Sun Prairie with thoughts. Hi, Steve. Good morning.
Morning. Thank you for taking my call. The tribalism's always been there. I know the guest talked about the whites being one big group, but, I mean, you go back in the day, and I don't know if the Irish considered themselves as part of just being white or the Italians or the Greeks. I mean, they were different, distinct groups, so that's always been there. So then you look at what's really happened in the past 10 years, and it seems like our race relations, at least according to studies that I've read, have really started going sour since President Obama was put in place. And he was one that really pushed with his surrogate identity politics, whether it was the guns and religion. And you could even put Hillary Clinton in that, what some of the disgusting things she said last week. So the social media that people go in their little corners with, the politicians identify, we can utilize this. And then the media just loves the eyeballs at the attention that all this thrice gets. And then on top of that, you can put in the Russians that are using that against us is what most of this probe is talking about. So I think in the past 10 years, it's gotten significantly worse than it's ever been in our country's history.
So Steve sees it playing out in many different arenas, Amy.
Yes, and so exactly. So part of it is also rooted in our changing demographics. When he mentions the racial dynamics, I myself wouldn't put it on President Obama. I think that part of this is this is a blunt thing, but the Irish and the Italians were very much very tribal. But those European groups who were, you know, I guess we would call them white, assimilated over time more smoothly, you know, and so that's, the numbers were smaller. And, you know, within a couple generations, you had Irish, Italians, people who are part Irish, part German, part English. So because in the last 30 years, our demographics have changed, that's some of the source of tension, too. I agree with the caller that these comments where you just label, whichever side, when you label a huge number of people whom you've never met, you know, something, calling them like backwards or deplorable, that is just not good coming from any side. And everybody does it. I've studied, my field has been kind of ethnicity and prejudice. That's what I've studied mostly in other countries for 20 years. And it's the definition of a stereotype or a prejudice to say, okay, this large group of people, this million people whom I've never met, never looked at, never shaken their hands, are X quality, whether it's, you know, racist or this or misogynist or that. And that's kind of what I'm trying to even get the caller to see, which is, it's so easy to be mad at the other side. And the wonderful studies that I cite are very hopeful. It's my favorite part of the book. There are all these studies that show that if you can pull people out of their tribes, and that's actually very hard because we kind of travel with our tribes. But if you can take, let's say, somebody who's a Trump supporter and an anti-Trump person and put them in the room and say, let's not talk politics, but talk about your dreams for your children or your sports or dogs, your pets, or your favorite kind of pizza, what people will come together. This is what happened when we integrated the military in the 1950s.
And we have to pause right there. Amy Chua with us on Political Tribes, Group Instinct, and the Fate of Nations, back after this news. America has historically been both an ethnic supergroup, as author Amy Chua has described it to us, and a strong collective of people from a whole lot of backgrounds, and perhaps unaware to the pervasiveness of tribalism in other countries. Bottom line, end of the day, can Americans get along? Do Americans want to get along? And who is ready to listen? The new book is Political Tribes, Group Instinct, and the Fate of Nations. Amy Chua stays with us. She is a Yale law professor. Getting your insights as well at 800-642-1234. What has today's political climate taught you? Do you feel entrenched in your views? Do you see yourself reaching out, or do you feel reluctant to listen right now? Call in, tweet us at WPR Mornings. Amy Chua, I want to perhaps give you a little bit of pushback to an ivory tower type criticism that how could a Yale professor with an Ivy League pedigree really get this, that you can't truly understand tribalism if you haven't lived the depth of despair where you have nothing to your life. You are a nobody. I'm thinking along the dirt roads of rural pockets in the Mississippi Delta or in the bombed out shells of cities in Syria.
Well, thank you for that. I actually kind of acknowledge that. And all I can do is I try to be a different type of Ivy League professor, because you'll see that my book is a little bit of a critique of coastal elites. Actually, it's kind of a big critique. And this is going to sound strange, but in my research assistants, I used about 30 people. I deliberately try to open my own eyes. So I had met one of my main research assistants was a Republican, very, very poor white student from South Carolina who is nothing like what you would think would be a Yale law student, pro-guns, pro-hunting, who felt very, very alienated at Yale Law School, very out of place. And I also, at the other end, had lots of research assistants who came, in fact, from Libya, and just different places. So he's right, or the person is right. I actually say that the reason we are at this state of polarization is because a lot of our elites, professional elites, just kind of went into their bubbles, thought that they had everything right, kind of imposed their view on the world, like, oh, let's all be very cosmopolitan and multicultural and we're so tolerant, without really understanding that they themselves don't really know their rest of the country very well, without really seeing that they are actually very tribal and kind of judgmental and intolerant in their own way. So again, it's really difficult to not point fingers. Every time I start talking, I notice in America people saying, wait, but isn't it really the other side's fault? And I'm just saying, I just don't know if that's productive anymore, because it's almost like two children. I have two daughters when they were little. It's her fault. No, she started it. She started it. And yes, I'm not saying all things are equal. There are some really heinous bad things that are worse than other things. White supremacy, racism, so things have to be called out, or murder, but otherwise, I just think that people need to stop pointing fingers and calling names, each other names, and just trying to see people on the other side of the political divide as human beings with children, with similar dreams, with love for the country that may look very different, their vision for the country, and just to try to piece this country back together. We have polarizing politicians, we have polarizing social media, but beneath it all, as I've traveled the country, I have found people tired of this. Like, they want to actually reach out. And again, my favorite parts of the book are the optimistic parts. Look at these studies. Look at these new groups. They're not the loud ones screaming on cable news. There's this group called the Better Angels that brings pro-Trump people with anti-Trump people together to talk. It's not kumbaya. It's not like now they love each other. But it's more like, okay, we understand now that why we have some of the differences. So that's kind of where I want to help move the country. And honestly, I think it's where most people want to go.
Let's bring in Sharon now from Madison. Hi, Sharon.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
There's just a comment earlier in the hour that hasn't set well with me, and that is that a large number of white people feel that they are discriminated against. And as a white middle-aged woman, I would invite all of the white population to do some research on white privilege and what we have had as white people as opposed to all other races, and try to walk a mile in their shoes. Thank you for taking my call.
Sharon, thanks. Amy, your thoughts.
Very
white
important
privilege.
Comment. We all need to walk a mile in each other's shoes. And she's absolutely right. I mean, it's and, you know, in a way, I almost think that we should not get into what I call compression, you know, oppression Olympics. Just who is... It is absolutely true that we have a history of slavery in this country that is lasted for so long and that still has legacy today. And that is just a fact. So I do appreciate her comment. But I just like to reframe things, you know, because the problem is that when people feel discriminated against or persecuted, and you just say, no, you're not, get over it, you're actually super, super privileged, it doesn't work. I mean, you have to kind of show people. And that's what I'm calling for. Say, look, I just want you, I like what she said. Walk a mile in my, here's my life. Let's talk about your life. And I, instead of competing to see who is most suffering, look, the people have common problems.
And when you say that we have to view each other as fellow Americans, or that we need to find a new national identity that encompasses us, is that really possible? There is generations and generations of issues that we've had to grapple with. How can you get to that ideal? And is it a real ideal?
I think it is. It's so, maybe it's I'm the idealistic daughter of two immigrants. Immigrants are often, my parents were liberated by General MacArthur in the Philippines in the Second World War. They're Chinese, but they lived in the Philippines, and they were under Japanese occupation. The population was being tortured, and General MacArthur and the U.S. Army, you know, liberated them. So they just love this country, and I've seen them subject to so much discrimination. We actually started off with no money. I went to public school. We never spent anything. To answer your question, even though we do have generations and generations of things that we need to address, slavery is, we can't just say, hey, that's over now. I mean, we have long-standing problems resulting from just the subjugation, the killing of populations, but we have a constitution. The founders may not have been, may have, you know, had slaves and very, very imperfect. There was a lot of hypocrisy, but the document that they produced and that we amended is really special and really unique. Again, under the Constitution, America's identity doesn't belong to any subgroup. It's ethnically and religiously neutral. So I think that we have the apparatus. We have the secret formula. I go around and people always ask me in the country, is there another country that we could look to as a model to overcome our deep divisions? And I'm like, America's the model, you know, and I agree. It's not going to be easy. And honestly, it's going to take will, the will of the people. It's not. It's going to take some courageous leaders, but you could hear in your callers how frustrated people feel on both sides, and I get that. I feel that way.
John in Rhinelander has been sticking with us through the hour here. John, go ahead.
Hi, thank you, Amy, for writing your book. I would like to read it because I'm a big fan of sociology. But my grandpa and grandma left Germany from the Nazis because they're German Jews, the Rothschilds from the Rhineland. They came to New York and then to Chicago, then to Milwaukee. Now I'm living in Rhinelander, and I'm the great white hope, if I can say those words. When I was in Boston on training, for company training, I was driving a rental car, I was pulled over by the police. He come up to the window and he says, where are you going? Now, because I was a white man and I took a wrong turn, I was driving through a transitional neighborhood. I was going towards the combat zone of Boston. Now, I ask you, Was he racial profiling me, or was he looking out for the protection of people and property?
John, thanks for the call. Amy, how would you respond to that?
Well, it's just very interesting. I mean, he's raising so many different issues. I don't even know where to begin. But yes, America's a complicated society. What I say in my book is that we are, you know, there's always a fight now. Everything is either or. You know, was it economic anxiety or racism that led to the 2016? We should stop trying to make everything black or white, either or. Everything is complicated. So what I say relative to the question is America is a country that has been exceptionally diverse and inclusive in the sense of assimilating immigrants from all different backgrounds. That's just true, as the caller, you know, highlighted.
So if we could... and we're running short on time, Amy. We have about 1 minute.
We're also racist, yeah.
Yeah,
I was going to say we're also exceptionally racist, and that's also true. So we need to kind of address both parts.
So, and we're short on time here, but if we could do one thing as individuals or in our own communities, within our own tribes to address this issue, what would you suggest?
Talk to one person on the other side. Don't go with your gang of friends. Just find one person on the other side and sit down for a cup of coffee. I think, and just don't talk politics. Talk about other things. I think that would just, actually, it's not just me thinking. These studies show that that just does wonders.
But we have our social media, and we resort to our own homes. I mean, how do you get people out to do that?
You know, I've seen people say, I'm just going to get off of this Facebook thing, because Facebook and social media reinforces our worldview. So it's going to take an effort. I mean, you're absolutely right. It's not easy. Everything is kind of pushing in the direction of more tribalism. But just take a look at the country that we all love, and for all its flaws, and just, is it worth saving? You know, I mean, I have people saying, no, let's break up into two, Heartland versus Coast. And I just think that's playing with fire, because I've studied countries that have actually fallen apart.
Amy, thank you so much for your time. Appreciate it. Amy Chua is the John M. Duff Jr. Professor at Yale Law School. She's the author of several books, including her latest that we've been talking about, Political Tribes, Group Instinct, and the Fate of Nations. This hour of The Morning Show was produced by Brianne Chasso and Nyasia Ellison. Michael Deringer provided technical direction. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and this conversation comes to you on the Ideas Network.